It's a pleasure to welcome you this evening to the fourth annual Hanomot Lecture on Jewish and Western Ethics. And over the past years, we've engaged some of the most pressing issues of our moment and examined them through these multiple prisms. How do we determine when life has come to an end? In light of breakneck scientific advancement, what's the future of the Jewish family? What's the role of Torah values in a liberal democracy? So we're delighted tonight to have with us two outstanding thinkers who will help us navigate the complexities of technology and the ethics of personal privacy. Now, in a little less than 2 weeks, we're going to read the book of Ruth. And it's always struck me that one of the most underappreciated messages of the Megillah is this notion of multiple perspectives. Now, the three central characters are all looking at the same narrative. They're all wrestling with the same objective reality. And yet Ruth, Boaz, and Naomi each have different ideas about how best to chart their future. They're not struggling with the question of right and wrong. They're struggling to order priorities in a world that's not only complex, but a world whose boundaries are constantly changing. As you know, part of our ongoing mission here at the Jewish Center is to pick up this thread of the Megillah, to grapple openly with the intersection of competing ideas and values. What happens when the ideas or ideals of Western philosophy brush up against Torah values? How do we reconcile them? How do we create a framework in which to lay out the issues and consider them thoughtfully and deliberately? It's no small matter to bring together the kinds of intellectual and moral firepower of the individuals before you today. It's a great privilege to have you gentlemen with us at the Jewish Center, and we're so thankful that you've arranged to be part of this extraordinary evening. You know, we take great pride in our continuing pursuit of excellence and our ongoing commitment to courageously confront these kinds of issues. So it's with a deep sense of personal and communal appreciation that I want to thank Mr. Hanoman not only for sponsoring tonight's conversation, but for bringing to our center his passion for intellectual inquiry. We freely confess that we may not have all the answers, but we take great pride in being able to host events like this one where we can grapple with the difficult questions. Hanno, thank you for making all of this possible. Now, based on the few moments of the reception upstairs, it seems that our two speakers are known to every one of you. But just in case you are not intimately acquainted with their biographies, Rabbi Daniel Feldman is the rabbi of Congregation Or Sadia in Teaneck. He's a Rosh Yeshiva at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, Yeshiva University, an instructor in the Sy Sim School of Business and the Wurzweil School of Social Work, and serves as the executive editor of the REITS initiative of YU Press. He received his ordination, both Yora Yora and Yadin Yadin, from the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, where he was a fellow of the Bella and Harry Wexner Kollel Elyon. He's the author of The Right and the Good, Halacha and Human Relations, Divine Footsteps, Chesed and the Jewish Soul, and False Facts and True Rumors, Lashon Hara and Contemporary Culture, as well as three volumes of Talmudic essays entitled Bina Basfarim. Rabbi Feldman is also the co-editor of more than 10 volumes of Talmudic essays, and has written for publications such as the Orthodox Forum, the Oxford Handbook of Judaism and Economics. And I would just add on a personal note that Rabbi Feldman's grandparents and my own grandparents were good friends back in the old country, in the land that was home to so many pious Jews, the city today known as Los Angeles. So it's very special to renew our family bonds here this evening. Professor Sam Raskoff is an expert in national security law and serves as faculty director of the Center on Law and Security at New York University. Named a Carnegie Scholar in 2009, he served in the New York City Police Department as director of intelligence analysis and created and led a team responsible for assessing the terrorist threat to the city. Graduate of Harvard summa cum laude, Oxford with first class honors, and Yale Law School, Professor Raskoff previously served as a law clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Justice David Souter and to Judge Pierre Laval of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. He was also a special assistant with the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq and an associate at Wachtel Lipton. His publications include Presidential Intelligence, Counterterrorism and New Deterrence, Establishing Official Islam, The Law and Strategy of Counter-Radicalization, domesticating intelligence and the law of homegrown terrorism. If my relationship with Rabbi Feldman looks to the past, my relationship with Professor Raskoff looks to the future as we share a school. Both of our children attend Beit Rabban together. Following our speakers' presentations, we'll have some time for questions, but at this time, it's my pleasure to turn the program over to Professor Sam Raskoff.
Rabbi Levine, thank you so much for those warm words, and Rabbi Zirkin, I want to acknowledge you and the role you played in creating the momentum behind tonight's discussion. I have to say, I was in shul a lot a couple of years ago, saying Kaddish for my late father, Zichrono Livracha, and one doesn't relish being in those circumstances in any sense, but it was a certain amount of solace for me to show up here and to enjoy the warmth, the hospitality of this shul, led by Rabbi Levine and Rabbi Zirkin. I knew that this was always a place where there would be a warm reception, where there would be a friendly hello, and where there would be an intellectually curious conversation as well. So thank you for that, and thank you for your hachnasat orchim and your hospitality over the years. I should also say that I'm truly honored to be sharing a dais with Rabbi Feldman, who is an expert that I've listened to in the past and learned a tremendous amount from. So I'm honored to be here in dialogue with you. I should also say, probably, and this is going to be the last of my throat-clearing exercises for the evening, a special hello to one individual and one cohort. The individual is Judge Hellerstein. It's always an honor to be talking about these issues in front of someone who makes a living making the tough judgment calls, some of which I'll talk about this evening. But there's a difference between talking about them and then having to put your name at the bottom of an opinion where you have to essentially decide where the rubber's going to hit the road. And I have unyielding respect for the judge and the project of judging, especially in this very dicey area of national security. And finally, just a quick hello to my students, past and present. It's nifty that you guys thought that this was a cool way to spend your evening. Some of you are alumni, so there's not even a brownie points element to being here. So good for you for showing up, and nice to be kind of talking to you again. Okay, we begin. The enterprise that I am going to talk to you about this evening is surveillance. So briefly, let me say that surveillance is an extension of or part of the national security apparatus of the state. It's a form of intelligence gathering. The kind of surveillance that I'll focus on this evening tends to be the sort that is obtained through electronic eavesdropping, the exploitation of information on networks. So what I'm principally talking about, in other words, is the way that the government spies by tapping into your computer, by tapping into your phone, and by you, I sometimes mean the whole country, indeed, in some sense, the whole world. So I'll talk about surveillance. My next main topic will be the law of surveillance. And I'll give a little bit of a précis of where the law stands and where the doctrine has come in 2016. I'll leave a lot out necessarily, but I'll give a little bit of a flavor of where the legal architecture of surveillance oversight by law stacks up. And then finally, I'll identify a couple, but by not meant to be an exhaustive list, a couple of pressure points, a couple of places where I think the relationship between law and society on the one hand and surveillance on the other hand is coming to a head in a particularly worrisome or challenging sort of way. So three topics: what is surveillance, what's the legal architecture of surveillance, what are some culturally, ethically, legally dicey situations that come about in light of current surveillance practices, all in 12 to 15 minutes before I yield the floor to Rabbi Feldman. Can be done. Watch. Okay. Why do we spy? Why does the government spy? Why does the National Security Agency spy? Why does the GCHQ, which is the NSA's equivalent in the United Kingdom, spy? Why does the IDF's Unit A200 engage in intelligence gathering? It does so in order, obviously, to gain some kind of advantage in a confrontation with an adversary. Now, I'd like to offer to you this evening that the world of surveillance has fundamentally changed in two very, very important ways over the last 15 years. Whereas about 15 years ago, maybe it's more like 20 years ago, most of what we did in the name of collecting intelligence through electronic eavesdropping was done on dedicated networks. So that's just a way of saying most of what our spies did was to put taps on the cables going into or out of the Soviet mission. There was a defined adversary. The adversary was, by and large, overseas. Sometimes they might be here in the case of missions, let's say, or embassies. And there was a certain amount of precision that we could assume in how we could locate the adversary and how we would engage in surveillance of that adversary. But owing to the emergence of counterterrorism as the dominant, I would say, national security agenda item of today, the nature of the collection of intelligence has fundamentally changed in a couple of really important ways. One is, whereas before, as I said, we were tapping dedicated networks, now we're essentially tapping ordinary devices like your iPhone or your email account or your Facebook account. So we've moved essentially from a world in which the spying took place in a very focused environment. Think of John le Carré, think of James Bond, spy against spy. And now it's essentially moved to an environment where the spying is essentially going on in your own device or in the devices of many people, which raises, in a sense, a second point. The spying back in the day tended to be retail. In other words, it tended to be a matter of a bounded universe of adversaries, of Soviet spies. I'm using that as a kind of running motif here to make the comparison to today's world transparent. But whereas before it was a matter of tapping into the phones of a specific number in a defined universe of Soviet spies, now it's a matter of potentially tapping the phones of everyone and collecting the email accounts of everyone so as to determine where the threat is emanating from. Because after all, if there's something that we all know about counterterrorism, it's that the adversary tends to blend in to non-adversarial environments. Now, that's not always the case. A place like Raqqa is a place where the adversary is concentrated. But ISIS operatives are known to leave Raqqa and show up in places like Brussels or Paris or Facemish, maybe New York at some point. And with that in mind, that surveillance, electronic surveillance, has fundamentally been re-architected, I would say, over the last 15 years, away from a world in which there was a defined adversary and we would use a defined technology to essentially grab intelligence on that adversary, to a world in which intelligence gathering means tapping the fiber optic cable that comes into the United States, or tapping the phones that we all use, or thinking about the metadata, which is the question of where you are when you place your phone call, and to whom you call, and how long you were on the phone as opposed to the content. These things have all changed. And obviously, if counterterrorism has been the reason behind much of this change, the other has been the emergence of technology. So half of the world is now online. There are now more cell phones in the world than there are human beings in the world. And so every time you see a cell phone, what the folks in the NSA see is a surveillance device. It was famously said by Meir Dagan, who ran the Mossad and died recently, that he would never use a cell phone, never carry a cell phone, because he made too much of his business exploiting other people's irresponsibility in their cell phones. He knew better than to carry one himself. So the nature of the surveillance business is changing fundamentally, away from tapping embassies towards tapping everyone's device in order to find out where a threat might be, including, and this is a key point, including in Western societies, including right here in the United States. This is the strategic and the technological pressure, the vectors that are essentially causing surveillance fundamentally to look different today in 2016 from how it looked in 2000 or at the end of the Cold War. Question. That's essentially the lay of the land in surveillance. How are we doing in the legal architecture and the legal regulation of surveillance? I would say so-so. So obviously, we all know, or many of us know, especially the lawyers in the room, that the ur source of privacy law and privacy regulation in our society is none other than the Fourth Amendment. I should say up front, the Fourth Amendment isn't where all the action is at in privacy regulation. The 14th Amendment performs some work. That's essentially the guarantee of equality before the law. Arguably, in some circumstances, the First Amendment and its guarantee of free speech or free association or free religious exercise might have some role to play in shaping the government's ability to collect intelligence in the sorts of ways that I'm talking about. But the Fourth Amendment, I think we can all agree, is essentially where it all cashes out, where the rubber truly does hit the road. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation. So two themes emerge, I would say, very, very starkly from all of our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. One is the requirement that government searches be reasonable, and the other is the requirement that the government obtain permission from a magistrate, someone like Judge Hellerstein or someone working for Judge Hellerstein, before they can proceed and tap a phone or get into someone's email account. Here's the problem. The problem is that that architecture, the regulatory architecture, if you will, of the Fourth Amendment, presupposes the old kind of surveillance, by and large. It presupposes a world, that is, in which what the government is trying to do is to tap an individual's phone or an individual's device to get information about someone as to whom the government nurses some kind of suspicion of wrongdoing. But in a world in which the government needs, so it says anyway, to absorb tons of information, arguably all of the electronic information that it's able to absorb, I've heard it said by someone who would know that the rate-limiting factor for what the NSA collects is the amount of water that's available to cool its servers. So as long as there's enough water in a place like Utah and Bluffdale to cool the servers, they want to have it. The appetite, as one of my spy friends once put it to me, the appetite comes with the eating. And that's certainly the sensibility, not just of people at Kiddush, but also of the American intelligence establishment. So there's a mismatch. What I want to say is there's a mismatch between the Fourth Amendment law as we have it, a law that essentially is designed in order to authorize particular intercepts, particular interventions into the privacy of individuals on the one hand, and an emerging strategic and technological requirement that the government collect information en masse. Now, we've gone partway, I would say, over the last years to resolving some of the tensions surrounding this disconnect between what surveillance has become and what the legal architecture of surveillance is all about. But I would say we've been only very partly successful. So there's been some reform last summer. Congress passed a law called the USA Freedom Act, which curtailed some of the ability of government to collect on a warrantless basis all of the metadata that was being absorbed into the servers in a place like the NSA. But I would say that's only a very partial step, and it's still the case that there's a lot of activity out there in the national security world that is essentially at this point unregulated, at least unregulated meaningfully by law. So where do we go from here? How am I doing on time, by the way? Am I roughly in the 12-minute range? I guess what I want to say is that there are three main challenges. We can talk a lot, and I gather that the nature of our evening's discussion is that there will be time for the rabbi and I to discuss and for folks in the room to raise questions. So consider this an opening bid at a conversation that obviously requires a lot more time and attention. But I think there are three, broadly speaking, three significant vectors for pressure on the current arrangement, putting aside the points I've just made about the mismatch between the legal regulation of surveillance and the practice of surveillance nowadays. So let me mention three. One is this. As a cultural matter, most of us, and here I mean to include or to specify in particular the folks in the room who are, let's say, under 30 years old, most of us lead lives nowadays that are thoroughly online and in a sense exposed, possibly more exposed than they've ever been in the history of humanity. So we put that information online. There's a declining, as a friend of mine likes to say, there's a declining half-life of secrecy nowadays, such that when the government engages in the collection of intelligence, there's more expectation nowadays that that information will get revealed, whether it's Edward Snowden, whether it's Julian Assange, I don't know. But the point is, it's harder than ever in a world in which there are thousands and tens of thousands, really, of people who work in this intelligence domain, some of whom believe deeply in the value of transparency. It's harder than it's ever been to keep a true secret. So I think there's a lot of cultural pressure out there coming from young folks. If I took a straw poll in my classroom, you guys can correct me. My sense is that Edward Snowden comes out a hero, not a traitor, about 99% of the time. Maybe it's 98% of the time. So that gives you a sense of what the sensibility of a kind of young, educated, thinking lawyer is like in 2016. And I think what that does is that means that there's going to be a lot more involvement, including by judges. I think it's likely to be the case that courts, which have historically tiptoed around the issue of national security surveillance and the Fourth Amendment implications of it, I think those courts are going to become more and more involved in these issues because they've become more central to our society Okay, point one. Here's another point which is related. The issue nowadays looks a lot like the public interest as espoused by the security apparatus, the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, on the one hand, and industry on the other. Why is that? Because when you want to do mass surveillance, when you want to absorb tons of data into your servers in order to locate threats and find needles in haystacks or to take the shape of haystacks, as it's sometimes said, you need to collaborate for the government with industry, in particular with Silicon Valley and high technology firms. And that was all great, which is to say the kind of collaborative project of Google and Facebook and Yahoo and Quest and AT&T and Verizon working hand in hand with the NSA, that worked somewhat until the declining half-life of secrets reality essentially emerged as a defining feature of the space. Because what happened then was that if you were a CEO of a company, let's take Apple, the most valuable company in the world, if you were CEO of a company and you were looking to augment your sales of your devices in places like China or Brazil or Europe, and bear in mind the next billion users of the internet will not be in the United States, they'll be in places like China and India and Brazil. So you're thinking about your market share in places like that. If you care deeply about selling your device or selling your service around the world, then global audiences matter intensely as essentially a participant in the debate about surveillance. And it's not a fully adequate answer, indeed it's not even a partially adequate answer, oftentimes for Tim Cook to look his Chinese consumers or potentially Chinese customers in the eye and say, hey, we do a lot of business with the NSA, don't mind us. Or to tell his German customers that we do a lot of business with the NSA, but don't mind us. So private industry, in particular, the CEOs of high technology firms, whether it's Tim Cook, whether it's Mark Zuckerberg, you name it, these guys are all of a sudden, thanks to the publicity that the issue currently enjoys, they're all of a sudden in the awkward position, I would say to put it mildly, of having to take a stance powerfully against the American security state, against the surveillance state. And you saw this, of course, in the showdown in the last months between Tim Cook of Apple and Jim Comey of the FBI over the encryption of the iPhone. But that's only one small data point in a much larger debate or much larger conversation that's been going on for a while, but it's really reached, I would say, a kind of critical juncture of late. So the public-private collaboration in surveillance is putting a ton of pressure on this project, because if you're the CEO, you're the board, you care about profits, you care about meeting your kind of your shareholder expectations every quarter, you don't necessarily care as intensely, or as acutely anyway, about the imperative of national security. And the discrepancy between those two incentives is very powerful. Let me just conclude by mentioning one more aspect of what makes this issue so hard, and I hope this is a good segue to Rabbi Feldman's discussion. Notions of privacy are very, very theoretically, I would say, underdeveloped in our society. We often don't know what we mean when we talk about privacy. Some people, and there's a kind of rich tradition of thinking along these terms inside the United States, when they think about privacy, are really thinking about power. So what they really mean when they say that they don't want the NSA leafing through their email accounts or their search engine history or their phone records, what they really mean is they don't want to create the conditions for autocratic rule inside this country. They don't want to empower, essentially, the government to have the ability to know everything about its citizens for fear that that won't lead to a robust and healthy democratic political culture. So some people think it's centrally about power. For other people, and I'm thinking here mainly about folks in continental Europe and places like Germany and France, the privacy debate sounds very different. They're very comfortable in those countries, have tended to be very comfortable with spy agencies operating on their own data. They tend to be less comfortable with American spy agencies, but that's a kind of French mission gossip, I would say. Where they're less comfortable, actually, is with companies like Facebook and Google knowing everything there is to know about folks. So actually, the concern in continental Europe is motivated much less by a worry about a police state and much more about a concern or a preoccupation with corporate power that goes unregulated. Two very, very different views of privacy. And I would say that in places like the United Kingdom, and here I'm going out on a limb and don't know that much, but you know, it's sort of an informed speculation, even in a place like Israel, there really isn't that much of a culture of attention to these issues. And I think there's much more willingness to let the issue essentially slide and to pay attention neither to the worry about the authorization of government on the one hand or corporate power on the other. So what it is that we mean by privacy is itself culturally determined and vastly and importantly under-theorized. We don't have a good working account of what we mean by privacy. And that, I think, will also play out in these debates, and these debates will be with us over the next years and decades for sure. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Professor Askoff. You make me a little afraid to pick up a microphone, but thank you for your kind words, and thank you, Levine, for your kind words. I do cherish our shared roots, but I hope I'm not only a part of your past, I hope part of your future as well. I haven't said anything offensive yet, I hope. But it's really a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Bezirkin, and thank you to all of you who are here tonight. I think it's my job for the next few minutes to talk a little bit about perspectives of Jewish law on issues of privacy and some of the tensions that exist that we perceive on our own and that can be found within Jewish law related to this issue, and just try to sketch out as much as we can in a few minutes. There are a number of sources that we find which do emphasize strongly a value of privacy. And a lot of them are rooted in the ethic of what's known as Lashon Hara. We generally relate to Lashon Hara as a prohibition to speak badly about people, to speak in a derogatory fashion about others. But there's a lot more to it. It's a whole ethic of speech, and a lot of it has to do with privacy and confidentiality. The word that the Torah uses for one who engages in Lashon Hara, that phrase, Lashon Hara, doesn't actually appear in the Chumash, in the Torah. The most likely source for the prohibition is a verse that we read a few weeks ago in Parshas Kedoshim, where the Torah tells us, Lo Selech Rachel B'Amecha, we shouldn't travel as a talebearer. The word Rachel sounds like a word that means a peddler, somebody who's going around with his wares. He's selling things, and apparently the Torah means it in the sense of somebody who has items of gossip to transfer to others. And so that's not only about saying bad things or derogatory things. We find that very connected to issues of privacy and confidentiality. And in fact, there's another verse that's not in the Chumash, it's in Sefer Mishlei, in the book of Proverbs, where we're given another clue as to what it means to be a rochel, what it means to have this attribute that the Torah is talking about, because that verse tells us, Holech rochel megalosot, that somebody who is a kind of a peddler personality, somebody who travels around as that kind of a persona, is one who reveals secrets, is one who breaks confidences. And we find the Talmud actually tells us that if somebody tells you anything, the default premise should be that it's confidential, that you're not supposed to reveal something someone tells you unless they explicitly tell you that it's okay. So in other words, the default should be that anything anyone tells you is a private matter unless said otherwise. And the commentaries tell us that that's probably not an absolute prohibition. It's more of what we call derech eretz. That's a good way to act. That's a good policy in life. But certainly when something is explicitly confidential, when it's clear either from the context or from the directive of the person speaking to you, so we do find an absolute prohibition under this broad rubric of rechilus, of lashon hara, of talebearing, that includes breaking confidences. And we find also a whole separate discussion which is quite fascinating. And the Talmud, in the beginning of Bava Basra, Daf Yomi this week, is going to start learning Nezikin. So part of what's called Nezikin is Maseches Bava Basra. Daf Yomi will get up to it in about 7 months. So in the beginning of Bava Basra, so there is an important passage which gets to privacy kind of through the back door, or more literally through the back window. The Talmud talks about if you're building an addition onto your house, let's say you're building some construction, and your neighbor is concerned that now you're going to have a line of sight into their property. You're building a higher level to your house, and now all of a sudden you have more of a vantage, a view into their property than you had before, that the neighbor has a right to object. And depending on how we balance the various rights here, there may be indeed the privilege to the neighbor to say, I'm not going to allow this because of what the Talmud characterizes as hezek re'iyah. Hezek is to damage someone. That's the beginning of Bavakama, which Daf Yomi will start this week. You cause somebody a damage through breaking their property. That's called hezek. And the Talmud tells us is a concept also called hezek re'iyah, that you're damaging someone through looking at them, through spying on them. And the commentaries explain many different angles to what's involved when we talk about hezek re'iyah. That on the one hand, so we have what might be a monetary angle, that perhaps the individual wants to conduct business in their property and they can't do that anymore if they don't have privacy, if people can now see areas they couldn't see before, or their property is not worth as much because they don't have the ability to act in a private manner like they could before. So it's maybe a monetary issue. It's something we could attach to dollars and cents, or others suggest that it's not that, but it's the psychic pain that comes from being spied on, that comes from knowing somebody is watching you when they shouldn't be, and that's what the Talmud is identifying as actual harm that you can stop someone else from doing, that you can say, I can't live like this, and therefore you can't build onto your house the way you intend to because of the harm that you're inflicting upon me. So these passages about this concept of hezek re'iyah are the source of a lot of the literature, and there's more that we'll maybe come back to later that come out from that passage. And then you find some of the commentaries like the Ramban who throw in another angle there, and they say, you know what else the problem is? The problem is lashon hara. And there's nothing derogatory that's being said. He's apparently using it in the sense that just as soon as people are in each other's business, all of a sudden, as soon as people are able to know what the others are doing, even if it's not inherently bad, that's already something that we're worried about. So we have the broad concept of tail-bearing, which seems to include all kinds of encroaching on other people's privacy and confidentiality. And then we also have a more direct connection that's many have pointed out, that when we talk about lashon hara, again, it's not just that it's derogatory, but Maimonides, for example, when he defines it, he defines lashon hara as saying something that causes problems to other people. So you can cause problems by hurting their reputation and saying negative things, or you can cause them psychic anguish by revealing things that are private, and that's apparently also included within that same definition. That's all considered to be a problem of lashon hara. So that's an issue. That's something that we find. And when we talk about tail-bearing, some of the early commentaries write also that tail-bearing means it has this connotation that you're gathering stories from one place and giving them to others in different places. Why can't you gather stories for yourself? Maybe you can play two roles. You're both the speaker and the listener. You're seeking out other people's private information so you can tell yourself what's going on with those people. That's also an act of lashon hara that's no different from involving a third party. So we find all of this literature focused on confidentiality coming from a lashon hara rubric. And that's significant, because if that's really where we're coming from, so we also find that sometimes that's balanced, that we know that just like when lashon hara is prohibited in the classical sense of saying something derogatory about someone else, so normally that's prohibited, but we also know that there are times when it's permitted and necessary, that if somebody poses a danger to someone else, if somebody is a predator, somebody is some kind of a risk, so you are not only not forbidden from revealing that, you're obligated to reveal that. And if that's the rubric for confidentiality, so we find that same dynamic here also, that just as much as we have an imperative that's very strong on keeping confidences and respecting privacy, at the same time, when there is some kind of a risk to someone else, that becomes a much more complicated issue. So there's quite extensive literature. For example, when we talk about the various professions in our contemporary culture where there is an ethic of confidentiality, whether it's the clergy or whether it's psychologists or lawyers or doctors or others who have a professional expectation of confidentiality. So there, the halacha recognizes that also, recognizes it even without the professional obligations because of what we've said already, and certainly recognizes it within the context of where it's expected as a professional ethic. But we'll also perceive a greater tension if somebody else, a third party, is at risk because of something that was revealed to a psychologist or a social worker or a lawyer. There'll be a greater consideration that that might be necessary to reveal. That might be a tension that also comes from that direction of having to protect the innocent, and that could become the dominant factor. So it becomes a very complex balance. Many factors are involved. And I think it's instructive to note also that we find in some of the literature. So, for example, there's a contemporary halachic authority who's very well known for dealing with a lot of fascinating issues, named Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein. So, Rabbi Zilberstein, who writes a lot about the medical issues and a lot of fascinating questions of modern life. So, in two places in his writings, he uses almost the same words to talk about two slightly different questions. And I think there's a slightly different balance reflected in each discussion. In one place, he talks about whether you can tap somebody's phone, whether you can record somebody's conversation without their permission. And he writes that, of course, that this is prohibited for many, many reasons. He writes that this is a violation of Lashon Hara. He writes that it's a violation of V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. That we know is a principle which probably primarily tells us how not to act towards other people, because it's a very high standard to say that you have to actively love others the same way you love yourself, but at least you shouldn't do bad things to others that you wouldn't want done to yourself. And many understand that to be a mandate against infringing on the privacy of others, eavesdropping and the like. So he writes, for sure, you're violating Lashon Hara, you're violating V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. There was much discussion about the enactment of Rabbeinu Gershom Meir HaGolo, who was one of the great Rishonim, who died in 1040, right when Rashi was born. And he's well known for many enactments, communal enactments and sanctions that he put in. And one of them was that you can't read other people's mail, which may also extend to revealing to others the content of mail that you get. And the assumption was that that's relevant to a lot of what we see nowadays, especially in the technology-driven world, where people very casually forward emails back and forth or copy people on emails in ways that they never would have thought to do so casually before this technology made it so easy. It never would occur to them that there are serious halachic issues. So many assume that this is connected to Rabbeinu Gershom's initial enactment, which provokes a whole discussion. The fact that he had to make an enactment, does that mean that the Torah otherwise would have been okay with this and he had to come and say, this is a bad idea? Or is it more likely the case that this is something which the Torah already really addressed, but people had become casual about for whatever reason and had become to perceive as something that was permissible, and therefore he had to make a big public statement and say that this is something we have to stop doing and we have to think twice about, which gives us a little bit of perspective on how we may have to reevaluate our landscape nowadays. So in the context of talking about tapping phones, Rabbi Zilberstein says, so you're going to violate Lashon Hara, and you'll violate love your neighbor as yourself, and you'll violate the enactment of Rabbeinu Gershom, and you'll violate four or five other things. It's for sure prohibited. But sometimes, who knows, maybe this person poses a danger to you, and maybe it's a real issue of life and death. So there might be circumstances where you may have to override all that, where it may still be justified. But the default is that it's prohibited unless it's justified by circumstances. So that's the discussion he has over there. And in another place in his writings, he has pretty much the exact same words, talking about a slightly different scenario. He's talking about if you're in a conversation with someone on the phone, you're speaking to someone on the phone, they know you're speaking to them, and you, without telling them, you want to record the conversation. So there he says pretty much the exact same things. You shouldn't do it. It's a violation of V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. It's a violation of Lashon Hara, all kinds of other issues. But again, if you feel that this person poses a danger to you, then there might be a justification for it. So I think it's interesting that here in these two different cases, he's saying almost the exact same words, that it's a balance between two different things. It's prohibited, but it could be justified under some circumstances. But that balance probably shifts depending on the circumstances. So those two cases, for example, if you talk about tapping somebody's phone in the first case, or recording a conversation that you are a part of in the second case, so the law views those two very differently. Right? So in the first case, then you need, as you pointed out, you need a judge, you need a governmental authority to do that. And in the second case, it depends what state you live in. Right? There are many states where it's legal to record somebody without their knowledge if you're a part of the conversation. So I think that reflects the fact that there's a difference between the severity of the two cases, and therefore the balance, even if we're saying the same words in both discussions, the balance becomes different. So the balance to be able to tap someone's phone, you can't make that decision on your own. You need a judge to sign off on it. And to tape a conversation that you're a part of, in some of the states, you can make that decision on your own if you feel that you're at risk and you may not be perceived as the nicest thing to do, but that's something that some of the states at least leave up to you to decide. So I think also the halacha probably will reflect that kind of difference as far as the balance is concerned. We find that both of these are points that we take very seriously. On the one hand, a strong default emphasis on a value of privacy and confidentiality, but on the other hand, also a strong importance on protecting the innocent, on making sure that that which is necessary to provide that protection is there. And when we focus even specifically on Lashon Hara, it's interesting that ever since the Chafetz Chaim wrote his Sefer on the laws of Lashon Hara, about 100 years ago, so there's been a lot of literature since then, and some of the literature that's written more recently, which comments on the Chafetz Chaim, notes that our culture has shifted a little bit, that the nature of interaction is different than it once was, and for our own protection and safety, we may have a greater need to know more about the people around us than we used to. And therefore, whatever our evaluating standard was in the past for what kind of information about others is relevant to us, maybe that's different. Maybe the call that we make, the evaluation of that has shifted a little bit, and that's a part of the judgment call that is now upon us in this new era, in this new generation, where we're more connected than we ever were. We have more ways of communicating, more ways in which everything that we do impacts everyone around us. So that raises all kinds of interesting questions as to how we balance all of these issues that we find in the halachic literature, and that seems to be a big backdrop for us to think about as we evaluate these questions.
I'm struck, Rabbi, listening to you by how Jewish, in a sense, our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence is. Maybe that's not an accident. Actually, the most important statement on the Fourth Amendment and its role in shaping privacy is a Law Review article that was co-authored by Justice Brandeis in 1890, where he famously introduced the idea of the right to be let alone as motivating the right to privacy. I wonder, it's unlikely, I guess, that Justice Brandeis was aware of the Chafetz Chaim, but they probably wrote it kind of in similar times. Yeah. It wasn't until 1927, when the author of that Law Review article was now in the Supreme Court, that he was able to pen an opinion. Unfortunately, it was still a dissenting opinion, because the dominant view in 1927, 37 years after he wrote the article, was still that tapping a phone was somehow different from opening up a piece of mail. It wasn't until 1967 that essentially the insight that Brandeis had as a law professor migrated from a dissenting opinion. 4 years later, it becomes part of the orthodoxy of the Supreme Court. And we've been fighting about it ever since, what it means, the right to be let alone, what it means to have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And maybe I can put a question to you, Rabbi, based on the sources that you were referring to, and specifically a point that you raised towards the end of your remarks, which is that somehow cultural expectations shape legal requirements. And so there's a sense, I would say, in the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, because it's pegged to an ideal of reasonableness, it's not the case that all government surveillance is prohibited, it's that unreasonable searches are prohibited. So it falls to a magistrate to make a determination on what is and what's not reasonable. That standard has been, I guess, criticized as being, in its way, circular, a reasonable expectation of privacy. Whatever it is that we expect to be protected can then be backed up by the state. But if we have no reasonable expectation that it will be private, then we're essentially not entitled to raise a Fourth Amendment argument. So am I detecting in your remarks towards the end in particular a sense that the halakha, like the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, in a sense, builds in some kind of cultural expectation of reasonableness and shapes the legal requirement, tailors it in a sense, to suit the cultural standard of the day?
So, I think you're right. I actually didn't get to say that yet, but I think you're right. I was actually referring to a different component, but what you're saying is still true. I was referring to the balance of how we have to weigh one factor against the other and how that could change. Specifically, the last point was that because our lives impact each other's lives more than maybe they used to, that puts a greater need to know kind of responsibility on people. But it's also true, what you're saying for sure, that the cultural expectations, and if one would have the time to look through, there's, I guess here's another Daf Yomi plug, if one has one to learn Baba Basra in a few months and has time to go through the literature in the Gemara and elsewhere about this idea of Hezek Re'iyah, about damaging through seeing. So we see that a lot of it has to do with what would be normal. So for example, if somebody, they used to live in courtyards, what's called a chatzer, this comes up if you learn the laws of Erevin or of Hanukkah candles, you find that they used to have different living arrangements back then. So they all shared a courtyard. So even though you had exposure to people who already lived within your courtyard, so there is not absolute privacy, the Talmud would recognize the difference between that which you knew would be exposed to the four or five families in the courtyard and that which would be exposed to the larger population. Or for example, the Talmud also talks about that which is visible, but only visible to people who are standing on a chair looking and deciding to look, and that which is visible automatically to people because it's at a lower level, and how that impacts things. And I think that plays a big role if you have a discussion, for example, let's say about Google Earth or something like that, where yes, you know, somebody's front door is always visible to whoever happens to be walking past their house, but there's a difference between it being visible to the few individuals who may happen to walk past their house once a week, and anyone who could at any point anywhere in the world decide to look at their house, and how that shifts, even though it's the same possibility of exposure, but the degree makes a very significant difference. That's also a major part of the discussion, and I think also it illustrates your point about the expectations. So I mentioned that intentional eavesdropping for sure is something that you find tremendous criticism of when it's not justified, but at the same time, when it's not intentional, the halacha seems to see it in a different way, because we mentioned that the Talmud has this passage of Hezek Re'iyah, recognizing a damage that one can inflict by seeing someone else when they're otherwise private, and how that person, that victim, can say, okay, you can't build your house this way. So the commentary is right, that yes, there's a concept of Hezek Re'iyah, of damage through seeing, but there's no concept of Hezek Shmiyah, of damage through listening. So what does that mean? We just said that eavesdropping intentionally is a problem, but what they mean, the later sources explain, is that I can stop you from building this addition on your house if you'll have the line of sight into my house, but what if I think your house is too close to mine and you'll overhear my conversations? When I'm yelling at my family, you'll overhear it. And I don't want that, so I say that you should build your house farther away. So that apparently is not within my rights, because there the commentaries say, okay, so I shouldn't yell so much. I should talk a little more quietly. And that's my responsibility. I recognize that, okay, the people can overhear things, and therefore I don't have the right to say, don't build your house. Don't build your house when it's too close to mine. It's rather, it's my obligation to recognize that that's a possibility, that the houses are going to be close, and that therefore I have then the burden on me to understand the circumstances and to speak more quietly. And it's interesting, you talk about the overlap between the Jewish sources and some of the other literature. You've probably all heard the expression, the walls have ears. As far as I'm aware, the source of that expression is Rashi in Maseches Brachos. The Rashi says, Kedamri Inish, the Gemara says that if somebody has something private, that they should talk rather in an open field. They shouldn't talk in a closed building, because Rashi says, Kedamri Inish, as people say, Oznayim Lakosa. The walls have ears. It's a literal translation. Maybe the source is older than Rashi. I don't know. He said people say this, but it goes back, at least it is a Rishon. It is in the words of Rashi and the Gemara, that this is a consideration that we already find 1,000 years ago in the Rishonim, this idea of the walls have ears, and how that is a part of the advice that we're given and a part of the reality that when we know that's the case, that the walls have ears, then it's our obligation to factor that in and to not expect that what we say won't be overheard.
Yes, sir.
Now, you say you can't look from down above. What if you're walking along the street level? Does that mean that that someone has an obligation to close their windows when someone goes by? Or if I'm taking pictures, can I just take a picture of your living room and snap it?
So I don't actually remember that case. I don't know if you remember that case. But speaking about it abstractly, so there's two questions you're asking. One is, do I have an obligation in my house to close the windows? Again, I'm afraid of the microphones. The question was that apparently there was a case where a photographer took pictures into a house. Somebody was in their house thinking they were alone, and the photographer aimed the camera inside the house and published those pictures. And apparently the right to do that was upheld, but the understanding was that that wasn't a violation of privacy. I don't think the halacha would agree with that. I don't know if we necessarily have to say that it's either or, that the house